You are listening to the Council of Deans of Health podcast.
A warm welcome to everyone who's listening to the podcast on Engaging Allies. This is a podcast which is a part of the Council of Deans of Health Race Equity Month 2022. I'm Swati Kare. I'm a physiotherapist by background and a lecturer in physiotherapy from the School of Health Sciences, University of East Anglia. I'm also one of the fellows of the Council of Deans of Health, the fellowship that was awarded in 2022. I'm delighted we have here with us Dr. Paul Driscoll-Evans. He is the Pro Vice Chancellor of Health and Wellbeing at the University of Suffolk. Paul and I are here to talk about allyship today, and I would like to begin by exploring the term allyship further. Often people ask me about what does allyship mean or what does an ally mean, and I thought it would be good to sort of put some context around the word, just look at some definitions. So an ally is a person from a privileged background who works in conjunction with a marginalized group by supporting and actively working with them to advance their rights. Now, this can work in many contexts of marginalized groups, as we know, but today we are going to focus on engaging allies to reduce the racial disparities in health education. There are systematic disparities in healthcare academic sector. The report published by the Council in 2020 found that the healthcare academic workforce is less ethnically diverse than the wider education health workforce. There's a similar landscape within the NHS workforce, where fewer percentage of minoritized ethnic staff are in senior grade position. Now, there's further data that reveals Black, Asian, and minority ethnic staff, especially women, tend to be underrepresented in senior academic positions. So we have a lot of data which talks about the disparities in health education. So as part of the Race Equity Month, today we will talk about, or we will look at ways in which we can overcome some of the barriers. We can look at some strategies to overcome barriers for minoritized people at all levels of healthcare academic sector. So I'm going to ask Paul, because of his experience, as to what does he think allyship means, and how does being a good ally look like?
Hi, thank you, Swati, and thanks for having me talking with you here today on this podcast. So as you said, I am the Pro Vice Chancellor of Health and Wellbeing at the University of Suffolk. I'm also a white, very middle class man, and I recognise that I exist and I have a significant privilege with those roles. I'm a gay man, so you know, there is some diversity about me, but certainly in terms of this context, I recognize I'm significantly privileged. And I think for me, ideologically, it's incredibly important to recognize your privilege and the role that you can play and the power that you have within organizations, within society, both to oppress people, but also in order the ability that you have and the potential that you've got to lift people up and create opportunity wherever possible. So for me, being an ally, you know, whether that's around supporting gender, whether it's sexuality, whether it's race, is for me all around making sure we use the privilege and the power we've got to do good rather than use microaggressions or more macroaggressions to oppress others. One of the things that if I reflect on my experience and why this became so important to me was many years ago, I was in a meeting with, I was a head of department, and I was in a meeting with a number of members of staff, some of which I didn't know, and indeed they didn't know me. And as I sat in a meeting and had a, I sat next to someone I had worked with previously, and I happened to ask her where she was from. And the individual looked back at me with a real look of shock and horror on her face and said, asked me what did I mean? And I said, well, where are you from? And what I was meaning was, which school are you from? Because I didn't recognize her, didn't know who she was. But actually for her, she was taking, the inference was, you know, what is your country of origin? And I suddenly was very aware and very struck by the fact that it was not a microaggression because it wasn't my intention, but actually her experience must have been such that that's where her first line of thinking went to. And it really, and I then realized that even though that isn't what my intention was, it was very difficult to recover from that, to correct myself in a way that didn't look as if I was to rather backpedaling too much. So that was just an example for me when I was in practice a few years ago, to think, okay, I really have to think about the language I'm using, think about the context, and not make the assumption that everyone else has got the same privilege that I have got, and indeed has the same educational context and the same societal context. It's very easy for me as well. I live in Suffolk, and from demographically, we are not a particularly diverse community. And as a consequence, you know, I'm also aware that the staff coming to my university, they will encounter that more acutely if they come from a BAME background. And that's something also I'm aware of, but I previously had not seen that, had not had that insight. So I think it's really, so that's kind of where my personal recognition of this issue being really important started, because I realized the potential damage that can be done through not recognizing one's privilege. And then also it's taken me on this journey to say, actually, as a university, as a senior leader in a university, what can I do to be a true ally and to be proactive in that? Not suggesting that I'm always perfect either. And I think that's part of the process.
It's really interesting to hear about your individual experience, Paul, because there are little things that everybody does unknowingly, which can have different connotations for different people.
Absolutely. And I think the both passive, you know, any passive biases, but actually any active biases, you know, it's recognizing those. And like in that instance, as I described, it was using language clumsily that I should have known, I should have been more aware of, albeit it wasn't my intention. And I think I have a further example, which I'm genuinely ashamed about, but I'm going to share it because for me, being a true ally is about learning and growing and learning from your mistakes. And I think it's about being honest, and part of being an ally is being honest in this forum as well and sharing the messages. And again, if I go back to when I was new to academic leadership, I had to deal with a group of midwives, as one does, who were very upset about placements or something. And as student groups are want to do, they were very agitated and they were in a fair mood to complain, and probably quite rightly so. And I dealt with the complaint, and they were getting a fair momentum on their side, and I felt that I'd done all that I could do, and I was slightly frustrated that I was still having to reiterate these key points. And I found myself saying to a female student, "Yes, my dear, I understand your point, and I'm dealing with it." And I went away, and I got back to my office, and I was horrified. I used I called her my dear, because it was such a key example of using my privilege, my power, both organizational leadership power, but also my role as a man to dominate and to essentially shut her up in the conversation. I immediately reflected on it. I spoke to the cohort rep, found out who the person was who I'd spoken to, phoned her up directly myself, and personally apologized for using that language. And those two events happened around about the same time. And I have always I've always simultaneously been ashamed that I use that language, referring to a female student, and have endeavoured to improve and be better as a consequence.
So that's interesting. So to be an ally, it's also recognizing our own weaknesses and being aware, I think, is also most important.
I completely agree, Swati, because we are ultimately a product. We're all products of our own systems. So those biases, both in conduct and language, are hardwired into us. And again, for me, you know, being a good ally is about being open to listening. It's about being implicitly aware of your own biases and to be proactive about changing it. And for me, a big part of this has been around, or this journey is around trying to being aware of the biases myself and correcting them, but also making myself more aware of some of the struggles that others have experienced. So if we look at the decolonization of the curriculum effort, you know, my personal learning over the last 10 years has been incredibly steep in terms of the impact of colonialism on every aspect of British life, and certainly the way that we construct our curricula, and how we as educationalists can so easily bias our next generation of students by not scrutinizing those narratives enough. So for me, again, it's about learning about the history and then re-looking at your conduct and our practices and our policies and our procedures, and indeed our curricula through that new lens.
So obviously, Paul, you've given us a lot of insight into what a good ally can look like. And it's more to do with our own introspection, being more aware of our language, as you said, is really important. And taking this, because you talked about students and students on placements, which tends to be a very close topic when we talk about issues with racism. So is there anything you think we could do to support students on placements by being good allies?
Yes, absolutely, and without question. I think from my perspective, I am very aware that at the University of Suffolk, our cohorts have become increasingly diverse, which is the nature is we're a growing university, we are recruiting from a more national pool, and therefore we're seeing a more diverse student body. But I'm very aware that the vast majority of my staff are white, middle class people, and I find myself genuinely perturbed that actually if I've got a student with a Nigerian background coming on the course, you know, where is his or her role model? When do they see people who look like them in leadership positions around the university themselves? And indeed, part of that is extending into clinical practice. So again, talking very specifically about my region, I'm also aware that the demographics within the NHS in Suffolk is predominantly white, middle class as well. So, you know, the student who comes to the University of Suffolk with a Nigerian background may not see any academic staff that really look like them, and indeed may go into practice and not encounter a great deal of diversity in that setting as well. And that causes me some real challenges. Now, the issue for me is that that's not easily resolved. Because we find it, again, and forgive me, I'm talking about my organisation once more, we find it difficult to appoint a diverse workforce because our demographic and our region is not particularly diverse, and particularly those in health or social care who are coming through their professions with the qualifications they need to enter into higher education, once more, increasingly less diverse, again, in this region. So one of the things that we're working at with the University of Suffolk to do is to work with our partners across the integrated care systems to start a Stars of the Future program, where essentially we are going to be offering free CPD work and set up a fellowship scheme for individuals who are at bands 5 and 6 within our local healthcare organisations who are from a BAME background and who their employers wish to give further development. For me, trying to do that is a positive way of increasing the future leaders, increasing diversity in future leaders, and indeed using those individuals as fellows who can come into our organization and be positive role models for our students. It's in its embryonic stages, but we're going to be looking to run that across the Suffolk and North East Essex Integrated Care Board and into the Norfolk and Waverley Integrated Care Board as well. So trying to identify, see what we can do to be really proactive to increase that positive role models that are there. Now, it doesn't quite answer your question, and I guess I want to bounce it back to you to get your input in terms of from an academic perspective, because I think there are some issues for me around fitness to practice processes and recognition of all the challenges that our students have. But I'll come back to that. So what are your thoughts? What do you think we could do?
I think with my little experience with students and with students on placements, I had students on placements who come back and talk about their experiences with racial discrimination. And at that time, I didn't possibly know how to handle that situation. And I was thinking about how do I do this and where can I go to seek support? So even though I'm from a minoritized ethnic background, I was not necessarily empowered to deal with such a situation. So over the period of time in the last 20 years, I've sort of experienced that if I listen to the student, if I am empathetic towards what they're going through and create that atmosphere where they can come and confide in me, where they can come and talk to me, because often students do not talk about these experiences. So I think I strive to then, you know, create that open communication and create that safe space. So I know I assure them that this is confidential. This is not going to go anywhere without their consent. And one another thing for me that was important is to not be being judgmental. Like you said, we have our own biases, and naturally the biases that I have from my own background that can come through, and I can easily judge the situation. And I think that's what I learned, that I need to have an open mind and unbiased mind while listening to the students' experiences. And later on also think about what is the action that I can take. So can we then direct the students to report that the incidents that has happened, and in what way we can support the students? As well as I think there's this issue with placement educators, where placement educators often want to support the students and again necessarily are not sure about how they can do this with the students. So again, if there are ways in which we can empower our educators, I think that is also useful.
I completely agree. I think it's, and you're right, the real danger when we come to talk about this sort of subject is that people aren't aware of their own biases, and they don't even make any attempt to acknowledge that they exist. I really like what you're saying about creating a culture and an environment where students feel supported pastorally, and recognizing that actually, even though you may be from a minority background, your experience will be different. And it's not that actually there's a binary that we should be adhering to. And I think it's for something I also, when I think about allyship, is like looking around the table that I sit at and identifying, and I do it quite regularly. In fact, I had the privilege of going to a wedding in South of France last week, and I realized that there was only one person there from quite 50 people, 60 people, there's only one person there from a non-white background, so from BME background. And I suddenly, and again, part of reflecting my experience, I thought, how does it feel to be that person? She will know that she is the only person there who is from a BAME background. And I think having that visibility, just having that sight, is what's really, really important. Again, how you then deals with that's really important as well. And I think acknowledging it is really vital. So if we're around a board table, if I'm around a committee table, and one looks and so often sees just a blatant lack of diversity. Although at the University of Suffolk, reflecting your point, we do become higher as we go higher in the organisation, it becomes incredibly diverse around the senior leadership team table. but it's just not reflected in the lower staffing groups. So I think it's visibility and again, recognizing where there are gaps around the table and what we should be doing to fill those. You know, positive recruitment is a key action that should be undertaken as well.
Clearly, you've talked about the barriers. That just takes me to the issue about, like you said, in the higher management, you have people from the minoritized ethnic background, whereas in the middle management, you probably don't have. And so there is this issue about how can we encourage minoritized ethnic people to put themselves forward to these positions. And we do know that there are a number of barriers, and some of them have been known to us. It's about lack of role models, which we have talked about just now. It may be to do with less mentorship opportunities, and it may also be to do with stereotyping. So people just don't perceive minoritized ethnic people in those leadership positions. So there could be a number of barriers. So is it that by being an ally, you can help those people in any way you think, or we need to do something else?
I think what's, again, I keep talking about representation, but I get horrified when one sees public facing materials from a university and they're not demonstrating diverse student bodies in publicity materials. So I think people need to see, both students and prospective staff need to see people who look like them on publicity materials, and that's really key. We've just designed a new health and wellbeing building, and I got the a professional graphic designer to do some mock-up images, as you would. And every single person, every single model that they'd used and computer generated was white. And I say, I can't believe I'm having to tell you as a professional graphic designer that this is not okay. So I think being proactive and pushing that agenda is really important. I also think in terms of recruitment, blind recruitment, you know, there's that, you know, I know there's studies in terms of not seeing a candidate's name can help increase kind of diverse pools of applicants that are shortlisted, certainly. So I think that's really, really important. And even from a really basic level, just making sure that staff across the organization have done unconscious bias training, that they know what unconscious biases are and that you're able to have that conversation is really, really important. So I think it's about getting more visible role models, as we said, greater representation, making sure that the right training is in place for staff and it's given proper attention and priority, not that it's tokenistic. And do the structural things with HR processes that mean that actually any biases that are there that may still exist after the training and after the awareness are not able to influence decision making.
So yes, certainly there are a number of things. I mean, like you said, starting at the very basic level of how someone's marketing material is and you know what does that reflect are such basic questions, and I think we need to take time to address those questions. I mean, many times all the colleagues that I speak to, they are supportive of equality. They do want to support their colleagues who may not be from a similar background to theirs. And they want to know what are those strategies or how we can help or how we can be an ally to my colleague and how we can help them. Because sometimes it's just those strategies. So I've seen something happen to my colleague, but I do not know what is the course of action. Sometimes I don't know how to go and approach that situation because I know something is going wrong, but I do not know how to handle it. So, Paul, are there sort of any practical strategies you think people can undertake?
I think it's very simple. And someone listens to this may really challenge that. But I think if you're in a situation that you're identifying something that you are concerned and is problematic, then you must raise it. So speaking to the individual themselves, speaking to my organization, it's the HR team, get that advice, find out more information, get some advice and read. And going back to the point I was raising earlier, you know, find out more about the scenario. Why do you think something may be occurring that you're not comfortable with. What's triggering that? And I'm almost convinced that if you feel that something isn't right, something problematic will be occurring. And that's not to assume that everyone is oppressed, and so everyone from minority group is oppressed, but equally, it's really important that we're open and we just ask those questions. What do you think? What would your response be?
It's basically, again, as you said, it's understanding that or recognizing that, yes, they do support their colleagues who are in that position. But I think sometimes by not saying something, that colleague doesn't know that, yes, I have this colleague support with me. And just I think by knowing that this colleague supports me, gives that empowering feeling to that person, because they think that their what they have gone through has been listened to, has been validated by that person when they've spoken to. And the first thing is whether I feel comfortable, first of all, to go and speak to my colleague about that situation. And if we have that sort of an atmosphere, I think we always, you know, like to be in that sort of a work environment where we think, yes, we can speak openly to our colleagues and our colleagues are supportive. So I think it's this first thing about being supportive to your colleagues and just sometimes asking them, maybe, you know, in what way I can help you. So sometimes it's just kind of, you need somebody, you've gone through something and you need someone to listen to what you've gone through. So just giving them an ear sometimes.
I agree. And I think for me, being an ally is about, you know, or having an ally is having someone by your side. Yeah, someone, you know, it may not be all the time, it may just be about specific issues, but just someone who is looking out for you. And I think that's incredibly important. I really do.
And at the level of higher education, as you know, Paul, we've got the race equality charter, and you know, some universities have gone for that, have adopted the charter, and some universities may be in preparation of adopting the charter. So there are other things that have been suggested in terms of encouraging minoritized ethnic people to go in for those leadership positions or to promote them to go into those positions. Some of the things that are suggested are, you know, reverse mentoring. And I just had a quick look, or, you know, when I first got introduced to reverse mentoring, I thought, oh, what is that? I have never heard of this. So I did look into it and I thought, oh, actually, I would like to be, you know, maybe have a mentor who is a student. So for example, from a different cultural background to mine, and understand what they have gone through or they go through on the course, because that's necessarily not something that I see as a lecturer from one end. So I have quite a specific view of things. So I think sometimes from that point of view, to understand what students go through, if they've gone through some experiences on placements, adverse experiences on placements, I want to see it through their lens. So I think I feel I would be up for having a student who's a mentor and just kind of learning from them and understanding the issues better from them. So
I completely agree. And I've spoken to my line manager about getting a reverse mentor for that very reason. It's very easy, particularly as you go become a more senior leader within an organization, to become more distant to those ground level issues and concerns. And I think one thing I've really enjoyed about our relationship, Swati, is that you as my mentee, well, firstly, I don't really feel that that's the case. You know, it's great to have someone who I work with who can become a friend and a colleague, which is really nice. But actually, I've learned as much from you about your experiences and in this relationship as hopefully I have been helpful to you. So I think one of the things, while I know we're not in a reverse mentorship arrangement, I've learned a great deal about your experiences, and it's helped me become, I think it's helped me become a better manager too. And I get to do things like this, which is nice too.
I mean, likewise, with Mohammed, one of the things that the Council of Deans Fellowship, I must say, has given me the opportunity to have you as my mentor, as well as learn, because you've been sharing a number of things with me about, you know, the strategies that you use and the experiences that you have, and your journey from being the dean to the pro VC. So I've got a good sort of view of what you've gone through and how your journey has been. And as you said, not necessarily the journey has been smooth always. And you've shared the kind of obstacles that you come across So I think that has been an eye-opener for me to say that, yes, when you go through this leadership path, what are the kind of things you're likely to experience? So yes, there has been a wealth of information or a wealth of knowledge that I've had from you and from the interactions that we've had throughout the year. So then considering going through this idea about mentorship, I do feel that mentorship does help, because it just gave a different perspective about leadership and the roles of leadership and what somebody might be signing up to if they are going to go on that path.
Yeah, I completely agree. You said something really interesting, which I think it very much applies to the concept of allyship, which is nobody comes out on the first day. One gets promoted to become a head of department or a head of the team, whatever. And you don't automatically become a good leader. It just doesn't happen like that. It takes time, and it takes time to evolve and grow and learn. And same thing goes with allyship. It takes time to grow and recognize your biases and the journey that you need to be on. And for me, I will still have biases. I try and tackle them as frequently as I acknowledge and see them and stop it from impacting my professional practice. But it's part of the human condition, and we will always grow. And that's why I think that vigilance is so very important. And again, reverse mentoring is a great way of just increasing your exposure and your line of sight to on this issue.
So I would like to thank you, Paul, for joining us and giving us that insight and giving us those views on allyship.
Pleasure, my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I know how busy it is considering the time of the year, and it's very busy. So thank you for taking time to join us. For the listeners, there'll be more podcasts all throughout November, as well as webinars and blogs. So you can find out more and engage using the hashtag Race Equity Month on Twitter. So thank you once again, Paul, and thank you everyone for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Council of Deans of Health podcast. For more information, please visit councilofdeans.org.uk.